talk about hormones in an organized way. Now, we've already talked about hormones a bit. We talked a lot about glucagon and insulin. We talked about homeostasis. Epinephrine came up. Vasopressin was on the exam. But what I want to do is put them together. Now, at the end of lecture 16, we had a little table about all the ways of keeping track of hormones. And you may remember that one of them was by the glands that make them. And that's the approach we're going to take today. We're going to talk about the major glands and the hormones they make. We're not going to cover everything, just the major players. Now, you may remember what hormones are for. We've discussed this before. Therefore, the stress response, remember the call from the dean. They are for taking care of episodic events like eating and maintaining homeostasis. These two are related. And also talking about growth overall. Now, most of the hormones do not directly stimulate growth, although some of them do, but if we talk about signal molecules in general, the growth factors do stimulate growth, although most of those are paracrines and not endocrines. Now, the most important thing to remember is that many of the hormones are listed under more than one category because they serve more than one function. For example, cortisol is involved in stress, but it's also a major player in energy metabolism. Insulin is involved in regulating glucose, but it's also involved in growth. So that's enough of an introduction, and now I want to get down to business. And maybe the best thing to do is to start with 22B. Because most of what we're going to do today is on these handouts. Now, you can see from looking at this handout that almost everything on the top is connected to everything else. But there are two glands on the bottom right that are not connected to the rest. So we're going to talk about those two first. And then we're going to talk about the others. Now, these are the pancreas and the adrenal medulla. We've actually talked about their hormones already before because the two major hormones of the pancreas are glucagon and insulin. And we've already discussed what stimulates their production, which is primarily, you might call it local conditions. That is the glucose levels in the blood at the pancreas. But in addition, there is input from the autonomic nervous system into the pancreas. So both neural messages and local conditions govern the production of glucagon and insulin. Now, the pancreas does some other things that we haven't talked about at all. It turns out that not only is it an endocrine gland, because it secretes endocrines, but it's also an exocrine. Now, we talked earlier about the difference between exocrine secretions and endocrine secretions. Endocrines are released into the blood, travel around to their targets. Exocrines are released either to the outside of the body or to a luminar space inside. But what I want to talk about today briefly is the difference in the glands that make them. And that's diagrammed on A on the middle. We've talked about epithelial cells many times and that they tend to form layers. This is, of course, a cross-section of a sheet. But during development, these layers can fold in and form glands. Most glands are of epithelial origin, but there are And what happens next, though, there are two possibilities. Now, these cells of the gland are going to secrete something, but there are two possibilities. One is that they're exocrine, they're going to secrete to the outside through a duct. And the way that works is that the folded, infolded section remains attached to the outside epithelium. So you get a picture like the one on the top. So you have a lumen or a space in the middle of the gland, and then you have the gland itself. But now you have a duct or a hollow tube connecting either to the outside or the lumen of the GI tract or whatever space we have here. So when secretions are made by the cells, they go into the lumen through the duct to the outside. Now this is an exocrine gland, or a gland with a duct. An endocrine gland is a ductless gland. So let's see how that looks. That's the other example on your handout. And the idea there is that the folded part breaks off from the epithelium, and then the epithelium reseals. So you have a layer of epithelium still on the top, and then the cells that were folded in form a self-contained gland. Now, this can be solid, packed with cells, and it might have a lumen in the middle, but it doesn't have a duct. So anything that's secreted here is going to go into the interstitial fluid and eventually into the capillaries. Remember, the cells of the capillaries have spaces between them, so material can get into the capillaries and go through the circulation. And this is an endocrine or a ductless gland. Now, I have a question. Where do these cells of these glands get the raw materials to make their secretions out of? Where does that stuff come from? That's actually the same in both cases. Material comes from the blood, the raw materials, both for an endocrine gland and to an exocrine gland, come from the bloodstream. So what comes from the blood is the same, but where the secretions go is different. Now, maybe this is easier if we have some concrete examples. The adrenal medulla, well, it's an endocrine gland, but actually it's a neuroendocrine, so it's a bad example. A better example is the thyroid gland, for example, the gonads, and the adrenal cortex are, in fact, good examples of this. And, of course, the cells that make glucagon and the cells that make insulin. What's an example of an exocrine gland? Those are the glands that make tears, that make sweat, that make digestive enzymes. The pancreas, what's the exocrine part? There are cells in the pancreas that make digestive enzymes, and they go through a duct to the GI tract. So that's why we say that the pancreas is both exocrine and endocrine, because it takes cells that make endocrines and cells that make exocrine secretions. Okay. So after that digression about endocrines, exocrines, etc., let's come back here. We've talked about the pancreas. What about the adrenal? Now, we've already talked about the adrenal medulla because it's actually part of the autonomic nervous system. It's part of the sympathetic system. And it's actually the part of the adrenal, and the adrenal is really two glands in one. The adrenal medulla is in the middle, and the adrenal cortex is on the outside. Now, there are a lot of things called medulla. It just means the kernel. The kidney has a medulla, a lot of things do. It means the inner part. And the layer on the outside is the cortex. And both are made up of cells, although I haven't marked them. Now, this is two really different glands. And we'll meet another case of that later. These two are right next to each other, but they're of different origin and different function. Now, we already said what the adrenal medulla is made of. It's actually of nervous origin. It's a neuroendocrine, not a simple endocrine gland. Because remember, there are cells with their neurons with their cell bodies in the spinal cord that extend into the adrenal medulla. This is the equivalent to a preganglionic neuron of the ANS, of the sympathetic nervous system. Now, normally we would have a two-cell relay in the sympathetic nervous system or in the ANS overall. But here, the second set of cells, which actually make up the adrenal medulla, they're also neurons. They represent the postganglionic neurons, but they don't have very long axons. So as we've explained before, they release epinephrine into the bloodstream. So it's neural or neuronal input that kicks in the adrenal medulla and causes these neurons to secrete epinephrine, which is an endocrine, goes into the bloodstream, gets carried around, etc. What about the adrenal cortex? That is actually a standard epithelial tissue. It's of epithelial origin. And it secretes a hormone too, but its hormone is very different. It secretes several, but they're all steroids. If we were to compare the adrenal medulla and the cortex, the type of hormones they secrete are very different. They're epinephrine versus steroids. Now, why does this matter? Epinephrine's water-soluble. Its receptors are going to be where? They're going to be on the cell surface. But steroids are lipid-soluble. Where are their receptors going to be? They're going to be inside or intracellular. They're going to be standard transcription factors. So these are very different. Now, what kicks the cell, what kicks the gland into making them? We just said that it's neuronal input that makes the medulla secrete epinephrine. But it's hormonal input that makes the cortex secrete steroids. And that hormone binds to a surface receptor and causes the activation or synthesis of the enzymes to make the steroids. And this hormonal stimulus, we'll just give it a name to make it fit, is ACTH. But the important point is it's a hormone. And we've already said that these two have different origins during development, whether it's nervous tissue or whether it's epithelial. So we really have here two totally different glands, different origin, different function, and different control. Now, at this point, I want to do another brief digression. Because I've mentioned epinephrine. We've talked about epinephrine and norepinephrine many times, but we've never really looked closely at them. And their structures are shown on page 1, on 22A. Just so you get some idea of how they're related. Turns out that epinephrine, norepinephrine, and another famous signaling molecule, dopamine, are all derived from the amino acid tyrosine. And which one you have in a tissue depends on which enzymes you have. So if we start with tyrosine, which has a conjugated ring, one hydroxyl, and the CH2, this is the R group or the side chain of the amino acid, and then it has the standard amino acid parts, carboxyl, amino, and hydrogen. And I've written it in the unionized form for convenience, but you all know that at intracellular pH, both the carboxyl and the amino would be ionized. Now, this is tyrosine. Now, if you have the right enzymes, it gets converted to dopamine. And to do that, you have to knock off a carboxyl and add a hydroxyl. So the hydroxyl you add, as you can see by comparing your structures, is on the ring. And the carboxyl is this one, which you get rid of. And then you have dopamine. Dopamine is used as a neurotransmitter, and it's also used as a hormone, as we'll see later. Now, dopamine can be converted then by the next enzyme in this series into norepinephrine. And in order to do that, all we have to do is add another hydroxyl, except that one's over here, and get rid of one of the H's. Now, nor means without a methyl. So norepinephrine has no methyl, epinephrine has one, and if the cell has the third enzyme, you add a methyl and you get epinephrine. And you can see from your picture where the methyl goes. It goes over here, and we lose one hydrogen. Now you can see that all three of these are pretty similar. It appears that the number of different kinds of signaling molecules a cell can make is fairly limited. And this is one family. Now, these three signaling molecules are called catecholamines, as it says on your handout. And the reason for that is that this structure, this ring with the two hydroxyls, is called catechol. So they're all catecholamines. And they all use G-protein-coupled receptors. Now, we've already discussed that both epinephrine and norepinephrine use adrenergic receptors, although there are two main kinds, alpha and beta. And we didn't go into the fine points, but in the notes for reference, it reminds you that norepinephrine uses mostly alpha and epinephrine mostly beta. But dopamine has its own set of receptors. They're different. And it has several different ones. Now, all of these receptors are G-protein coupled receptors. But as you know from the exam, different ones can use different or similar G-proteins. So, depending on which G-protein is activated, you can either activate adenyl cyclase, inhibit adenyl cyclase, or activate phospholipase C. So you can trigger either the cyclic AMP pathway, or inhibit the cyclic AMP pathway, or trigger the IP3 pathway. And it depends on the case which you do. Okay. So I think that pretty much takes care of our two sort of on the side glands, and everything else is connected. But before we go to the connections, do I have questions about this so far? Yep? Is tyrosine itself a signal molecule? No, it's not. It's an amino acid. But as you'll see, thyroid hormone is also made from tyrosine, but in a very different way. All three of these, dopamine, norepinephrine, and epinephrine, are water-soluble, as you might expect, and they use cell surface receptors. But thyroid hormone is lipid-soluble and uses an intracellular receptor. Yeah? Does the adrenal medulla release any norepinephrine? Well, if you look at this pathway, there are three steps, three enzymes, and you can see that to get to epinephrine, you have to make norepinephrine first. So anytime you have epinephrine, you have a little bit of norepinephrine, but primarily the medulla releases epinephrine. Yeah. How does this gland stay put? Well, we've drawn this gland as if it's isolated, but remember, in your body, almost everything is connected, and there would be, if not muscle in here, there would be extracellular matrix material holding it. So there's plenty of stuff in here, I just haven't drawn it. Okay, so now we want to look at the rest of 22B, at all those other glands and hormones. Now you notice at the very top of everything is the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is part of the brain, and we've talked about it before. And we said in one of the circuits we were talking about it, it was the integrative center. It is actually the integrative center for a very large number of circuits. And it's sort of the master gland here in charge. And it gets input from three different places. So it gets hormonal input from circulating hormones from other glands. It gets neuronal input. Nerves both from the rest of the body and including the brain, of course. And it gets input from its own local conditions. If that's true, and we said the same thing for the pancreas, to get information from local conditions, what do you have to have? You have to have sensors. So, in fact, both the pancreas has sensors for sugar in the blood, although we haven't explained how it works. And the hypothalamus has sensors for many things, including temperature. That's how you detect core body temperature from a sensor in the hypothalamus. So all of these inputs together feed in, and the integration of all of them determines what will be happen next. Now, there are three inputs here, but there are two major outputs. So that's why we have two arrows. Either to the anterior pituitary, which is more toward the front, or the posterior pituitary, which is more toward the back. Now, these are really two separate glands. But just like with the adrenal parts, these two are right next to each other and are joined together and called the pituitary. But these have different origins, just like the different parts of the adrenal. That the posterior pituitary is actually of neuronal origin, comes from nerves, and the anterior pituitary is sort of an ordinary gland that comes from epithelial tissue. And these function quite differently, as we will explain in a little bit. Now, the posterior pituitary secretes only two hormones, and all the rest come from the other part. So let's look at those two first. And those two are oxytocin and vasopressin, or ADH. Now, we've already mentioned both of these, but I want to say some more about them. Both of these are small peptides, and they're extremely similar. They are homologous. That means they aren't just similar, they share a common evolutionary descent. What happened is there was one gene for one hormone, the gene duplicated, and the two copies have diverged. But they haven't diverged that much because these two peptides are extremely similar. And both of them work similarly in that they use G-protein-coupled receptors, and as you know by now from the exam, vasopressin can trigger either the IP3 pathway or the cyclic AMP pathway, depending on which G protein its respective receptor binds to. And oxytocin uses primarily the IP3 pathway. Now, why does this hormone have two names? It has two names because it was discovered twice. People who were working on blood pressure discovered it and discovered that it causes constriction of peripheral blood vessels and thereby increasing blood pressure, and they named it vasopressin. The people who were working on kidneys discovered this hormone and that it affected water transport. In fact, it affects recovery of water. It causes recovery of water so you keep it and you don't lose it in the urine. So they named it antidiuretic hormone, or ADH. They're exactly the same thing, but it was discovered twice. Now, the way I remember what diuretic means is I learned it from a very proper biochemistry professor who came in with his little bow tie, and he gave a very formal lecture until he got to ADH. And then he said, "Diuretic means to pee. Antidiuretic means not to pee." And I don't remember anything else about him except that. Okay, so ADH causes you to reserve water, and we'll explain how that works probably next time when we get to the kidney. Now, oxytocin primarily causes contractions of smooth muscle. We mentioned already how with the uterus, it promotes birth. With the breast, it promotes contraction of the cells which squeeze the milk-producing cells so that the milk is injected. You have to both make milk, that's a different hormone, and then you have to squeeze the milk out through contractions, that's this one, oxytocin. Okay. So that's this part. Now, the rest of it is all referred to as the hypothalamic adrenal anterior pituitary axis, or the HTAP axis, because everything is more or less connected. And that's what we're going to talk about next. The anterior pituitary makes two sets of hormones, one of which are tropic hormones, and then there's the rest of them, which for now we'll just call the other. We'll come back to them later, because we want to focus on the so-called tropic hormones. Now, what does tropic mean? It means that it promotes growth. So what these hormones do, and there are several of them, is that they promote the growth of another gland so that it can produce hormones. So that's written underneath here. You notice that they're sort of, let's start on the next board again. That there are actually three kinds of tropic hormones. Now, we've already mentioned ACTH. This stimulates the adrenal cortex. That's what the ACT is for. This is actually, the name, all of these things have more than one name. G This is actually also called adrenocorticotropic hormone, which is where its name comes from, but everybody calls it ACTH. Then there are the two LH and FSH. These are luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone, but what we're interested in is that they stimulate the gonads. ACTH stimulates the adrenal cortex. LH and FSH stimulate the gonads. So together, they're called gonadotropins. And ACTH is also called corticotropin or adrenal corticotropin, all of them being called something tropin. And the final one is thyroid-stimulating hormone, which is also called thyrotropin, which stimulates the thyroid. But we're not done, because these are glands, and they make hormones. So the adrenal cortex, we already know, makes steroids. The gonads make steroids, some of which are listed on your handout. And the thyroid makes thyroid hormone, usually called TH or thyroxine. Now, TH is not a steroid, but it is lipid-soluble. So all three of these are lipid-soluble. So there's one thing left off your handout. Where do these things go? They're no good unless they have some target organ or some target cells. So we should perhaps put back down here the targets. The only one I want to mention really is the target of thyroid hormone, which is almost everything. Thyroid hormone controls what is called the basal metabolic rate. It controls energy metabolism, how fast you burn glucose, how much oxygen you use up. Now, this is called the HTAP axis because it's a series of hormones and targets. You see, if we start at the top, that the hypothalamus makes a bunch of what are called releasing hormones because they cause the anterior pituitary to release tropic hormones or the others. There are different releasing hormones. They bind to different cell types in the pituitary, which make different tropic and other hormones. Some of these so-called releasing hormones or releasing factors are really inhibitory. But they're all, some of them inhibit release, some of them promote, but they're all called releasing hormones or releasing factors together. So this is sort of hormone one. But then the anterior pituitary, in response, makes these tropic hormones. This is set of hormones number two. And that hits the target glands. And then the glands make their respective hormone. That's hormone number three. So releasing hormone kicks in pituitary to make tropic hormone, kicks in gland to make actual hormone, which does something. So you have the hypothalamus, the anterior pituitary, the glands, and then the final target. Four kinds of cells, three kinds of hormones. Now, one thing all of these have in common is that there is feedback from the end hormone down here on its own production, usually negative feedback. And as a result, these end products are usually kept at more or less constant levels during ordinary growth. But we'll come back and talk a little bit more about regulation in a little while. Now, in order to explain this a little bit better, we have to do something about structure. Because the way in which the hypothalamus signals the anterior and the posterior pituitary is different. And that's made clearer if you look at the little picture with the box on the bottom of A, on the left. I take it back, it's B. Sorry. We'll get to A in a minute, but this one's on B. So here is the hypothalamus. The nose would be over here. This is sort of the front and the back. And here's the pituitary with its two parts, the anterior and the posterior. Now, as we've mentioned before, these two have different origins and they grow next to each other, but they're really quite different. Now, the hypothalamus is a part of the brain. It's neural tissue. It's made up of neurons. And some of these neurons have very long axons that end in the posterior pituitary. And these are the, this is where ADH, aka vasopressin, and oxytocin come from. So where are these hormones made? Oxytocin and vasopressin are proteins, they're peptides. So they have to be made up here in the cell body, because that's where the gene is. So the DNA has to be transcribed, the RNA has to be transported out of the nucleus, and these peptides are made in the cell body. But then they're released from the ends of the neuron, which are actually in the posterior pituitary. So these are usually called posterior pituitary hormones, but strictly speaking, you could say they're hypothalamic hormones because that's where they're actually made. Now, how do the hormones get from one end to the other? Remember we said that axons have microtubules inside, and proteins and peptides that are made in the cell body are packed into vesicles, and the vesicles travel down the microtubules to the ends of the axon. Now, when these hormones are released, where do they go? Where do endocrines and neuroendocrines go? They go into the blood supply, into the circulation. So you look at your handout, you notice that there's a blood vessel that comes into the posterior pituitary, and it goes out. So we would have an artery that branches into an arteriole. Which branches into capillaries. Now, then the capillaries come together to form first a venule, which then forms a vein. Now, these capillaries are really connected to each other. I just draw it this way to emphasize that there's very fine branching. But they're really connected, and it's what people call a capillary bed. Now, we've already talked about smooth muscles surrounding your circulation. Arteries, arterioles, venules, and veins have smooth muscle around them, and they can be constricted. But capillaries don't have smooth muscle around them. Because you want to promote exchange between the inside of the capillary and the outside, the interstitial fluid, and the cells. And to allow for exchange, you have only a single layer of endothelial cells on the outside of the capillaries and no smooth muscle. Now, this means that ADH and oxytocin go into the regular blood circulation. Now, how do things get from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary? Well, there are short axons in the hypothalamus that are making all those releasing factors. And they, too, go into the blood supply. So you have arteriole coming in. Now, if you had the usual situation, these would go into the general circulation and be carried all the way around, and they wouldn't get right to the anterior pituitary. But you have a short blood vessel or a shunt that goes directly from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary. And this is called a portal vessel. Now, to get some sense of how unusual this is, we have to look at the general setup of circulation. That's on the bottom of A. Now, this picture of the circulation is what one of my colleagues used to call a subway diagram, meaning that it shows you what's connected to what and what the flow is, but it does not represent proper geography at all. In order to make the pattern clear, some things have been terribly distorted. For example, in this picture, the two halves of the heart are written in separate places. Because this represents the right half of the heart, and this the left. Because humans have a double circulation, the blood flows from the heart into the lungs, back to the heart, into the body, etc. Now, of course, in real life, these two are right next to each other, and the whole thing's twisted around. But the way the blood from the body goes, each part of the heart has two, each side of the heart has two sections, which I'm sure most of you know, an atrium, which collects the blood, and then pumps it into the ventricle. And the ventricle then pumps it out either to the lungs or to the body. Now, this picture illustrates that there are actually two circulations, so to speak. There's the one to and from the lungs, which is called the pulmonary circulation. And then there's the one to and from the body, which is called the systemic circulation. Now, we've drawn out a few more details of the systemic circulation to make it clear that the blood flows through the different organs in series, in parallel, and not in series. Because here, for example, is the digestive tract, here's the liver, here's the brain, etc. So the blood flows with branching into all of them. So there are capillaries, there's the artery goes into arterioles, goes into capillaries in each organ. And then the capillaries take it out of the organ into venules and veins, and it goes back to the heart. Now, what's important about this picture is, how would a blood cell get from the digestive system to the liver? You have a cell right here. How can it get to the liver? If this picture is right, the only way is to go all the way around again. It has to go into the right side of the heart, around through the lungs, back through the left, and only then can it make it to the liver. But in fact, you have a portal vessel, which is a shunt or a shortcut that goes between the digestive system and the liver. And that allows the blood to flow through the digestive tract and carry stuff directly to the liver. Similarly, you have a portal vessel between the hypothalamus and the anterior pituitary. So this material doesn't go into the systemic circulation right away. It goes direct to the anterior pituitary. Now, once you get to the anterior pituitary, there's the standard arrangement of blood vessels, which means that whatever the anterior pituitary makes goes into the general circulation. Now, what's the point of all this? How much hypothalamic releasing factor do you need to kick in the anterior pituitary? You only need a little bit. because it's not diluted by the whole volume of the blood. It only goes through this one short blood vessel, and the concentration can be pretty high. But suppose some of this releasing factor gets into the general circulation. Will it do anything? It won't, because it gets diluted in the entire volume of the blood through the system, and the concentration is too low to do anything. However, anything made by the anterior pituitary will go into the systemic circulation and move around until it comes to the right target gland or organ. Now, what this says is that the hormones released from the posterior pituitary are really being released from the ends of axons that belong to the hypothalamus. The hormones that are being released in the anterior pituitary, though, were made there. They were kicked in by a secretion from the hypothalamus. But these secretions, tropic hormones, are actually made in the anterior pituitary. Now, I think that's enough about the digression about circulation. And now I want to talk a little bit more about the tropic hormones and these so-called other hormones that I wrote up there. All of these hormones, the tropic hormones, are all proteins or peptides that work through cyclic AMP. But the pseudotropic hormones work a little differently. Now, you notice if you look at your list of other hormones on B, there are quite a list there, but the first two are growth hormone and prolactin. And these are the pseudotropic hormones. Now, these, on the other hand, are the real honest-to-goodness tropics. And then, in addition, we have the real other hormones, like MSH, etc. We'll get back to that in a minute. Now, why are the pseudotropic called pseudotropic? Well, they're made by the anterior pituitary, and they stimulate something else to make a secretion. So that sort of sounds the same. They stimulate somebody to secrete something. But it isn't necessarily an endocrine that they secrete, and the thing that's secreted isn't necessarily an endocrine solution, secretion. So they don't necessarily stimulate an endocrine gland or lead to the production of an endocrine secretion. So let's look at what they do. Growth hormone affects many different tissues, but one of the primary ones is the liver. And the liver, in response, secretes actually something that acts like a hormone, but it's called a growth factor. It's called insulin-like growth factor. And it targets other cell types. Now, you can see this looks very much like the tropic situation, except that the liver is not what we usually think of as an endocrine gland. And other tissues also make insulin-like growth factors. And in that case, they're paracrines. So this setup isn't quite like a tropic hormone. In addition, there is feedback from these lipid-soluble hormones on their synthesis, and there isn't any feedback from ILGF on its synthesis. So it's a little bit different. Now, what about prolactin? Just as ADH and vasopressin are homologous, prolactin and growth hormone are homologous. They're quite similar. They share an evolutionary origin, and they work in a similar way. But one of the reasons they're separated from the tropics is they don't use G-protein-coupled receptors. They use a tyrosine kinase-linked receptor, the kind we haven't talked about yet. They all use surface receptors, but this is a different kind of surface receptor. So what does prolactin stimulate? It stimulates the tissue of the breast to make milk. Now, milk is not an endocrine secretion. Milk is an exocrine, and the breast is an exocrine organ or exocrine gland. So again, we have a hormone that stimulates somebody to make something, but they're not endocrines, they're exocrines. But you can see the parallel. Now, what about these so-called other hormones? The one we've written the name out of MSH, is melanocyte-stimulating hormone. Now, melanocytes are the cells that determine pigmentation. And this hormone was discovered because it stimulates them. But that presumably is not its only function. But the function of MSH and the other small ones, endorphins and cephalins, are really not known that well. And the reason I brought them up is not because of what they do, but because of how they're made. It turns out that melanocyte-stimulating hormone and endorphins and cephalins and ACTH all come from a single giant precursor protein known as POMC. Now, we've talked about alternate processing of RNA. This is a case of alternate processing of protein. This protein is cut up in different ways in different tissues. And depending on how you cut it up, you get ACTH or MSH or endorphins, etc. Now, we've actually talked about processing proteins before. Remember, when you make a protein, you might cut off the methionine, or you might cut off the signal peptide. In a way, this is a more extreme example of that. It turns out that a lot of proteins are processed before they reach their final stage. Signal peptide taken off, methionine taken off. But another common thing is to make the protein, if it's a hormone or a certain kind of enzyme, in an inactive form. When you make something like a trypsin or pepsin, these are digestive enzymes. They chew up other proteins. Do you want them working before they get there? You do not. The same is true of many hormones. You don't want it to work until it gets to the right place. So these proteins are made in an inactive form. Now, in the case of insulin, which is a hormone that you don't want to work prematurely, the inactive form is called proinsulin. But in many of these cases, like with trypsin or pepsin or chymotrypsin, the inactive one is called whatever it is, inogen. Like trypsinogen is the inactive form of trypsin. Pepsinogen is the inactive form of pepsin. Fibrinogen is the inactive form of fibrin, which makes your blood clot. It stays as fibrinogen until you need it, and then you cut off an extra piece. In all of these, the inactive form has an extra piece. Now, I didn't bring a model with me today, but it's sort of like the protein, the inogen, is like this. And then the enzyme comes and cuts off a piece, and zoing, it comes open. And now the protein is ready to work. So that's all I want to say about the other hormones. And now I want to spend some time talking about the thyroid. But before I do that, let me ask what questions there are. Insulin-like growth factor? When the question is insulin-like growth factor an endocrine or a paracrine? There are a bunch of insulin-like growth factors, and the one made by the liver does act like an endocrine. That is, it enters the blood and it travels around. But the ones made by other tissues act like a paracrine. They only act locally. Yeah.
Do the cells through the shunt only go in one direction?
To the cells of the?
Through the shunt.
Yeah. The question is, how does the blood flow? Yes. Remember, the blood is being pushed in this direction. And in the case here, it's being pushed this way. Because of the pumping of the heart, the blood only goes in one direction through the shunt. Now, I want to talk more about an example of how this axis works. And so we're going to look at one example. And the example I want to use is the thyroid and its hormones. And that's on C. Summarize the setup. You have the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus secretes a releasing hormone, a releasing factor, which in this case is called TRH. And then that goes to the anterior pituitary and causes it to release a tropic hormone, or TSH. And TSH stimulates the thyroid to make thyroid hormone, which stimulates many target cells. Now, TH is thyroid hormone or thyroxine. TSH is thyroid stimulating hormone or thyrotropin. And TRH is really thyrotropin-releasing hormone, or TSH-releasing hormone. But the idea is it's a releasing hormone, tropic hormone, and actual lipid-soluble hormone. That's the point. Now, the same thing happens with the production of some of the steroids from in these other cases. Among these steroids, for example, is cortisol. The one made by the adrenal cortex makes cortisol. And you would have an exactly equivalent thing. You'd have a releasing hormone, a stimulating hormone, cortisol, and a target. And with both cortisol and TH, not only is the setup the same, but the regulation is the same. That in the case of insulin, the level of insulin you have doesn't make any difference. It's the level of the things controlled by insulin that matter. But in the case of thyroid hormone, cortisol, and some of these others, the level of the hormone itself is regulated. If you have too much thyroid hormone, the targets have too high a basal metabolic rate, too low a thyroid hormone, too low. So the level of thyroid hormone is kept approximately constant by negative feedback. There is negative feedback both on the hypothalamus and the anterior pituitary. Probably the major effect is on the anterior pituitary. But there is probably less releasing, if there's a lot of thyroid hormone, there's less releasing hormone, and then less receptors or less response to it, so less stimulating hormone, so the thyroid doesn't make so much thyroid hormone, and you cut back. Now, we said that thyroid hormone is lipid-soluble, but it's not a steroid. How is it made? And this little picture on the side shows you how it's made. That, remember, endocrine glands have these sort of balls of cells. Your thyroid has a whole bunch of balls, and each one is called a follicle. And this is a cross-section of a piece of the follicle. Now, what happens is, can we just make thyroid hormone and hold it around? Well, can we make cortisol and hold it around? Cortisol is a steroid. Once you make it, you have to release it. Because remember, it can pass through membranes. Thyroid hormone can pass through membranes also. But you can't make thyroid hormone and hold on to it. But you can make a kind of precursor of thyroid hormone and hold on to that. And that precursor is a protein called thyroglobulin. Now, this protein is made in the ordinary way on the ER in the cells of the follicle. And then the protein is secreted into the lumen. Now, this protein has a lot of tyrosines. And remember, thyroid hormone is modified tyrosine. So, what happens is these tyrosines are modified, but it all remains attached until it's needed. But how it's modified is shown on the top. Thyroglobulin is an ordinary protein, and it has a lot of these tyrosines. Now, the tyrosines are modified by the addition of iodine. And the exact structure is drawn out on your handout. And then, using another enzyme, the ring of one tyrosine is cut off and stacked on top of another one. So, modified thyroglobulin has these double tyrosines with four iodines on them. Now, when you need thyroid hormone is what you get if you cut the peptide bond on each side and release the modified double tyrosine. And it's called T4 because it has four iodines on it. Now, we think that maybe the active form is really T3. The T4 goes through the blood to its target cells, and in its target cells, one of the iodines may be removed, activating it further. Now, how does this work? You take iodine into the cells, and it gets into the lumen. And then it's added to the thyroglobulin to make locked-in T4. And now, when you need thyroid hormone, you have to cut this up. Now, how are you going to cut it up? It has to be cut up inside the cells. So it has to go back into the cells. Now, how are you going to get a protein out of a cell into the lumen and from the lumen back into the cell? That's going to be exo and endocytosis. So you have essentially exocytosis, as shown in your handout, into the lumen, and then endocytosis back into the cell. But now you have a vesicle containing thyroglobulin. Where are you going to get the enzymes to cut it up? Well, you can peek and look on your handout, and you notice that it says lysosome. That you have lysosomes which contain the enzymes necessary to break up thyroglobulin. So these vesicles fuse together, and now you have the substrate, the thyroglobulin, you have the enzymes, and now you can cut up the thyroglobulin. Well, what does that get you? That gets you T4. Can you hold on to T4? T4 is that doubly modified tyrosine, and it's lipid-soluble. It's not a steroid, but all three of these act the same way. They're lipid-soluble, so you can't hold them inside a vesicle. They just diffuse out of the cell. But remember, lipid-soluble hormones and molecules don't just travel around through the blood by themselves. They're always attached to a protein. So there is a T4-binding protein, which the T4 sticks to and goes through the blood to its target cells. Now, where does iodine come from? Iodine comes primarily from the ocean, from the sea, from seaweed, from fish, so that people who live near the ocean almost never have a deficiency of iodine, and so they don't have any problem. They can make thyroid hormone. But people who live where there is no ocean often don't get enough thyroid hormone, and that can be very serious. It's quite serious in an adult because your metabolism doesn't run properly, but it's even more serious in a child during development. The child's brain doesn't develop properly. So if you don't have thyroid hormone, it's very serious. Now, do you need to eat iodine every day? You can't store thyroid hormone, but what can you store? You can store modified thyroglobulin. So that allows you to take in iodine and store it for several, I think, months' worth. So you have iodine trapped. But until you cut up the thyroglobulin, it's not released. Now, the thyroid is the only tissue which takes up iodine. And therefore, if you're exposed to radioactive iodine, where does it end up? It ends up in your thyroid, and it can cause damage. So what do? You may, if you've been reading the paper, you notice that the people who live in Japan have been taking iodine pills. You take potassium iodide pills. The idea is the amount of loose iodine floating around is quite small. So if you add unradioactive iodine, it dilutes out the radioactive, and the thyroglobulin you make has normal iodine in it, and you don't have a problem. So that's why they give people unlabeled iodine. Now, I didn't get to the last handout in the morning, and I'm not going to do it now. It's an example of how you use all of this, and it's largely for reference. And I didn't talk about all the details of regulation of the thyroid, and I'll do that next time. But I want to look and see if I forgot anything, because I know I talk faster and you had less questions. But I'm still sort of surprised that I finished so early. So let me just check. And let me also ask if there are any questions. Yeah. What does thyroid stimulating hormone do? It stimulates almost every step in this process of making thyroid hormone. Does it stimulate the storage of modified proteins? Yes. Yeah. You have to talk louder. Is there an inhibitory transcription factor? I don't think that's... No. Her question is, how does this inhibition work? Well, she's brought up a good point. If thyroid hormone is doing the inhibition, what kind of receptor does thyroid hormone have? Surface or intracellular? Is this lipid-soluble or water-soluble? This is lipid-soluble. So where is its receptor? It has to be inside or intracellular. And if we're blocking the production of, say, receptors for TRH or the synthesis of TSH, then in fact it's going to be an inhibitory transcription factor. Okay, so we'll stop here, and if anybody has any questions, you can ask.